Cassie McCullough, and this is Common Knowledge, where we cast an eye over some of the events of the week that have captured our curiosity and see what they can tell us about the world.
And I'm Jason DiRosso, and today, the power of anonymity in an increasingly public world. As Greece burned over EU austerity measures this week, the Anonymous movement joined the fray, taking down key government websites.
Greetings, Greece. We are Anonymous. You ignored our warnings and now we are in charge.
What's operating below the surface of this internet subculture?
Oh, it's all so dramatic. Also today, we're deep in red carpet season. We've had the Golden Globes, the Grammys, the BAFTAs. Next week, it's the Oscars. Has the red carpet become the world's most valuable advertising real estate?
Now, each week on Common Knowledge, we invite a guest to bring a different perspective on things and to radically increase our collective IQ. Today is no exception. We're very pleased to be joined by futurist and writer Mark Pesce. G'day, Mark.
G'day.
Now, first, let's go straight to Greece, because this was an interesting event, I think, during the week. The online activist group Anonymous, depending on your point of view, it's either the fresh face of collective action or it's mob rule in the digital age.
Let's go for a little bit of both on that. I'll take column A.
Well, we saw the images from Athens. It was of buildings burning and people on the street, and it was really clear that the situation there had gone from bad to worse. It's part of the ongoing issues with the EU. A second bailout is being negotiated, and there's a very real possibility that Greece may part ways with the Eurozone. So it's an incredibly fraught situation for that country. And into it steps this internet collective, Anonymous, which on Monday reportedly took down key national websites, including those of the Greek Prime Minister, the National Police, the Ministry of Finance and the Finance Minister's personal site, the Greek Parliament and also one of the major television channels. Then a message from Anonymous began circulating on the web. It had the kind of trademark, I guess you'd call it a calling card of Anonymous. It was a man wearing a Guy Fawkes mask and reading a statement with his voice digitally disguised.
Yeah, it's all part of the iconography of Anonymous, the mask, the music, which is often used. There's a flag. It's a little bit like the old style kind of terrorist proclamation.
And a little bit like Dr. Evil sort of popping up on satellite, yeah. Right? I mean, it really does refer back to that in that it's both very serious and also, I think, not taking itself seriously at all. I think it's doing both at the same time.
Yeah, it's high drama, high camp on that. Why don't we hear the part of the message that they put out this week?
Democracy was given birth in your country, but you have now killed it. What an irony. Your own people hate you and you stare at them doing nothing to prevent that. You have joined the IMF against your people's acquiescence. You have so introduced a new dictatorship upon your people's shoulders and allowed the bankers and the monarchs of the EU to enslave them both economically and politically. You ignored our warnings and now we are in charge. We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. You should have expected us. People should not be afraid of their governments. It's governments that should be afraid of their people.
And on it goes. It's really high drama, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's making points that I think are very much sort of coming out of the net culture of libertarianism and the relationship of power to people, and that the network really reconfigures that power and gives power to people who previously thought themselves powerless. And so you can expect that when people think of themselves as being sufficiently powerless, something like Anonymous is going to find very fertile ground, because it's a way for people to act empowered and to act against powerful people who were trying to control them.
But right in that clip, we see the paradox. It's comic. It is funny. Mm. It is a kind of take on that schlock thing. And in fact, it is calling on a movie called V for Vendetta, right, which actually did have a scene like that in it. But at the same time, they've done something incredibly powerful and disruptive. They've taken down these key websites and shown real power.
Well, I mean, it's The Economist, when talking about Anonymous last year, really compared what they're called distributed denial of service attacks. That's the technical name for them, which is basically when you beam a website with so much traffic it has a nervous breakdown. They compared that to the modern version of the sit-in, when you basically go and invade a building and no one can get any business done because you can't enter and leave the building. And so this is the equivalent of that.
So the fresh face of collective action.
And now, of course, they're threatening to, I mean, this is just recent, but they're threatening to bring down the web completely
Indeed.
It was this very testosterone-charged kind of missive sent out.
So this is the thing. I mean, there's this thing that shows up on, it's a website called Pastebin. Now, Pastebin is a website that basically allows anyone to copy anything from anywhere and paste it up to this website completely anonymously. So people just share things. And up on Pastebin appeared this proclamation from, well, it claims to be anonymous, claiming to say that on March the 31st, we're going to shut down what they would call the domain name service, which is the thing that turns server names like Radio National into a number that a computer can access. There's 13 sites that do this for the entire planet. Now, it's probably not possible. Now, I say that with a great deal of caution because Anonymous has always shown itself to be very crafty and very capable. So I say probably not possible for Anonymous.
I think the thing that's though interesting about Anonymous and is that obviously it's a pseudonym behind which a lot of people, sometimes connected, sometimes not connected, are working. And so it's a very horizontally integrated kind of group. Now, we don't really know at any point who is really behind each anonymous missive, really. It's quite difficult to know. But I think it speaks to what's interesting, I think, about Anonymous is that it speaks to the way that we do organize ourselves in this contemporary era so often. I mean, if you think of things like, I don't know, the shareware programming movements, open source. Yeah. You know, I think of Subcomandante Marcos even in Chappas, who uses a lot of the same rhetoric. I mean, he's not online, really. It's not about an online presence. It's a very real regional kind of struggle in Mexico. He uses a lot of the same kind of rhetoric around not having a leader, around anyone being able to sort of buy into a movement and be part of it. The Black Bloc's another example.
I mean, I think that the lesson learned here is that whenever you have a movement that has a leader, you can bring the leader down. WikiLeaks is a really good example of this because Julian Assange is basically under house arrest in England because he attracted too much attention while he was trying to disrupt the system. So you need to then use an approach that is leaderless and there's nothing to attract.
But isn't it also a reaction against celebrity in a way, I guess, and against fame, and it's part of being a collective that has power, and it's about, in a world where everything we write on social media supposedly can be retrieved for all time, here's a chance to be truly free, to be anonymous and participate in something that's actually powerful in an age where we're really disempowered.
And that the only way you can be truly powerful is by being truly anonymous. That's the paradox, is that the more visible you are, the more you can be disempowered by people who can attack you because they know your true name. Right, but in the anonymity, you actually create the space for you to be able to act in power, but you can only do that in concert with other people. So there's a whole bunch of paradoxes that are in play, which allow you to be empowered, but only if you don't take any ownership of the power.
I know that the celebrities who turned up down at Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, what was it, Zuccotti Park or whatever, had their photos taken and then zipped off again, really annoyed part of the movement because that was exactly what it wasn't about.
Right.
It wasn't about being seen to be there. It was being faceless, being masked, just being one of the number.
I mean, I think people have learned a lot from the way that various movements were neutered, I think, in the middle part of the 20th century by having leaders that could be taken out.
Yeah. But it was very, I think it was very easy, given its origins in 4chan, this sort of very bizarre, very not safe for work bulletin
board. Yeah.
That has existed since 2003, that a lot of the environment in which it sort of stewed and came together was around this idea of anonymity, because that board really allows people to savage other people. And the safest position to do that from is from a position of anonymity. And so people sort of became aware of that correlation between power and anonymity there.
So you're talking about the most extreme versions of that being trolling of griefing sites where tributes, say, on Facebook, which have been defaced horribly and vandalised in the past. Yeah. That's the kind of extreme end of it. How does that fit into Anonymous?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to say how does anything fit into an Anonymous, because Anonymous is what some group of individuals who want to call themselves Anonymous have decided is important enough for them to care about. And even Anonymous, when some of its things get close to things that would be trolling or griefing, you can find other parts of Anonymous going, wait a minute, what's going on here? And so there seems to be, even within an Anonymous, an evolving consensus about what constitutes acceptable versus unacceptable behavior as Anonymous.
It's so a very it's a radical idea of self-policing, isn't it?
It's actually a huge experiment, really.
Yeah. Well, I know that in the mid-90s in Italy, for example, there was this pseudonym behind which a lot of pranksters sort of operated called the Luther Blissett Project. And that was the only thing they had that they specified that people couldn't do as a Luther Blissett was anything racist, fascist or sexist. Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I think these movements do have the capacity to self-regulate.
Yeah, they say they're doing it for the lulls, you know, they're doing it for the laughs, but they also have, well, Anonymous has a great sort of social justice agenda. Greece is just one example of what it was up to this week. It also was involved in trying to disband a Russian youth group, which is run by the Kremlin, very pro-Putin. Yeah. It exposed a Romanian spy ring, and on Tuesday, to mark the one-year anniversary of the protest uprisings in Bahrain, they attacked an American company that makes tear gas that's been used to quell the Arab Spring protests and released a whole lot of information, including employee details and the client list of this company, which was very interesting reading. And, yeah, they've had many, many targets like Scientology, the FBI, CIA.
CIA, was it last week? I think they took down the CIA website, the public-facing CIA website. It's interesting because there's been a debate visibly within Anonymous about whether it is about the lulls or whether there is a social project here. And it seems to be evolving to a social project as Anonymous becomes aware that it can be more than just a force, that it can be a force for some decided good, some consensus idea of what good is.
Maybe we'll get an answer on March 31.
We will expect them.
You're listening to Common Knowledge here on RN. I'm Cassie McCullough, and with me is co-host Jason DeRosso, and our guest today is futurist Mark Pesci. He's an honorary associate at the University of Sydney's Digital Cultures Program.
Well, it's awards season, which means red carpets, and that means celebrities, designer clothes, a lot of preening in front of the cameras, answering that all-important question of what are you wearing?
Who are you wearing, actually?
That's right. Now, we've already had the Golden Globes, the BAFTAs, the Grammys, and our own very glamorous Actor Awards.
I'm wearing the beautiful Alex Perry. My shoes and my handbag is Christian Louboutin. Beautiful Prada earrings. And my makeup and hair was done by the wonderful Linda Jeffries.
I'm wearing Victoria Beckham.
And why Victoria Beckham?
Look, I love her simplicity. I think her style's elegant. I think she knows female shapes. I don't feel like I'm as sort of thin as her to be in it. But I think they're extremely feminine and extremely simple.
That's actor Susie Porter there, one of the voices from the red carpet at the Actors, the Australian version of the Oscars. Yes, it's the old AFIs, recently held in Sydney. Now, next week, of course, the Oscar buzz is going to reach fever pitch in the lead up to the awards on Sunday. But what about this meld between fashion and business and celebrity and the proliferation, too, of shows about dressing celebrities, shows like The Rachel Zoe Project? Well, joining us now is editor of Harper's Bazaar magazine, Edwina McCann. Hi, Edwina.
Hi.
I can tell over the phone that you're already dressed better than all of us here together.
That's very nice of you to say so.
He's doing a disservice to us, actually, Edwina. I've been dressed today by Vivian Westwood. Mark's wearing Prada, I think.
Oh, fabulous. I'm wearing Burberry, so we all meld perfectly.
Let's talk about the red carpet and how and why it's taken over from the catwalk as the most important advertising in fashion real estate. Why has this happened?
Well, really, there's one person to point the finger at here, which is, Anna Wintour, the editor of US Vogue. She took the tack very early on of putting celebrities on the cover. Prior to that, it was mainly models, and the models were even built into the celebrities themselves. But she changed tacks completely. And in about 1996, we suddenly saw Uma Thurman arrive on the red carpet, dressed head to toe in Prada, Now, Prada at the time had made some nylon handbags and had become the sort of fashion darling because it was previously a very sort of old world luxury luggage company in Milan. And they had just really hit the runway with some of their first collections. So for an actress to be dressed head to toe in a reasonably obscure, I mean, you knew of Prada if you were in the fashion industry, but not a lot of people did beyond that, was kind of an indication that, hang on, something's going on here, somebody has got involved. That person was really Anna Wintour.
I mean, there are some fashion houses that actually don't do the haute couture catwalks anymore, don't they? They've actually opted to dress people on the red carpet instead of doing the old catwalk.
That's correct. So twice a year we have the ready-to-wear shows, which actually are on simultaneously with the Oscars, and then 3 months later you'll get the couture shows. So basically every 3 months you're getting these collections in Paris. The couture shows, though, are very much about showing off the atelier, showing off their fine work, if you like. And the argument's been going on for a long time, is couture, it's in haute couture, dead? Because really, are there the customers out there to order these $30,000 dresses and the likes made to measure for them in Paris? What seems to have come up and replaced it, so more and more houses have opted out of couture or have even just invested less money into their couture shows, so they've just got models standing still in the dresses rather than putting on a very elaborate show with, you know, big sets and the like that they've spent hundreds and thousands of dollars on. And instead, they're just investing in dressing celebrities, which is pretty much the same thing. It allows you to show off the hand woven, you know, beautiful, intricate detail or incredible beading, or spend an inordinate amount of money on a single, you know, a dress, if you like. And you would have to argue that by putting it on a celebrity on the red carpet, and particularly the Oscars, you're going to get more media coverage than you're ever going to get by putting it on a model in Paris, twice a year in this sort of very, very lofty world of fashion.
Well, as you've said there, right now the New York Fashion Week is wrapping up. We're heading into London Fashion Week, and then after that, Milan and Paris. But really what you're seeing in magazines such as yours and far trashier ones is what's happening on the red carpet, that you can't miss a 10 best and worst dressed at this time of year.
No, that's right. I mean, there is no doubt now that for a fashion brand, the currency is really the red carpet. That's how you can align yourself with like-minded people, like Mia Wasikowska recently, our young Australian star, has become the face of Miu Miu. Now, you'll see she appeared at the Actors, surprise, surprise, wearing Miu Miu. That's a way of Miu Miu and Mia aligning themselves with people who they see, I guess, as having the same aesthetic or perhaps the same sort of appeal to a similar demographic, and really combining to share the same message. Now, Mia wearing Miu Miu on the red carpet is going to be amplified perhaps thousands and thousands of times more than Miu Miu simply putting their ads, you know, in magazines. So it really is the extension, I guess, of their brand advertising.
It really is a business, actually, that you've just described, a business structure, I guess.
It is, and they invest a lot of money into it. I mean, you'll see in the next week in LA, we probably won't see it actually, but we know it's going on. There'll be styling suites set up by the biggest design houses of the world in, you know, the very exclusive hotels in Hollywood, where starlets will be invited, or rather their stylists with the starlets will be invited to come and see, you know, what they could be worn in. What they could wear on the night.
Oh, well, for just 5 minutes of a life like that. But just for a moment, maybe to you, Mark, if we take away the business side of all this, what else is going on the red carpet there? I mean, you're a futurist. What's being signalled by fashion this way?
Well, it's interesting because we have a sharing media culture now where people are just passing everything around. So the image of Adele at the Grammys this week, dressed beautifully, looking amazing, became an image that I couldn't avoid. Now, I like Adele as a singer, but the image was everywhere. It was on websites. It was on. Being passed around social media, so on and so forth. And
she wore that really body hugging black dress.
Yeah,
very classic. But she looked gorgeous. Yeah,
absolutely gorgeous on it. But that's the thing. We've all seen that image now because it's not really just what the television camera is catching. I didn't watch the Grammys, but it's because once the image is captured, it can now be pervasively spread. So, in other words, the fashion houses are using social media almost accidentally as a real force multiplier to be able to get the image out everywhere instantly.
Well, one of my favorite shows about celebrities and fashion is Fashion Police, because it comments on all these images. And we've got Joan Rivers and a panel who talk very bitchily about celebrity fashion faux pas and successes. It proves the red carpet is a very dangerous place to be. We're going to play this clip where Joan and company are talking about Katy Perry at the Grammys. She wore blue and had blue hair.
Katy Perry hit the red carpet wearing Ellie Saab Couture.
It is the bride of Smurfenstein. I thought she looked amazing, but old. And it was clear when she was wearing this dress that Katie and Russell would not last. There was more friction between them than between Christina Aguilera's thighs. So I knew.
I love it. I love the monochromatic dress. Look. I think her boobs look great.
Oh, they're saggy.
No, they look beautiful. They're not saggy at all.
She could carry pencils under there, George.
Yeah, the red carpet can be a very dangerous place to be. This, of course, you know, was first mentioned in an ancient play, Agamemnon, back in 458 BC, where Agamemnon comes back home and his wife, who's been having an affair, says, come and walk on this crimson path. And he's sort of like, well, he's killed soon afterwards. And in that play, of course, he also does express trepidation about walking on crimson because it's only befitting of the gods. So this notion that the gods walk along the red carpet and that it's also a dangerous place to be has been around for a while. Edwina, what happens when a celebrity dies on the red carpet? Figuratively speaking, of course, when what they're wearing just doesn't cut it.
Oh, look, it's a disaster for them, and it's an even bigger disaster for the fashion house who's dressed them. I mean, I think none of us can forget some of the big faux pas, like Bjork and the Swan, which I know, you know, some people thought was absolutely wonderful, but I think the fashion camps really, really trashed her. And the result has been, we've seen this proliferation, if you like, of the Rachel Zoes of the world, of stylists who don't actually work for magazines or do fashion shoots, but simply style celebrities. And the celebrities make no mistake, pay huge money to these stylists to make sure that they do not make the faux pas that's going to, you know, sink their image, guarantee they're never going to be on the cover of Harper's Bazaar or Vogue again, and mean that no fashion house, you know, worth its grain of salt is going to want to dress them.
Mm. Where are you going to be in a week's time, Edwina?
I'll be in Paris.
And will you be glued to the Oscars?
It's funny. You find that the fashion industry, because the shows are still ongoing when the Oscars are aired, there's a lot of gossip and talk about who looked good and who didn't. But it's kind of not cool to pay too much attention.
You're too far ahead.
We're way too far ahead for that.
Oh, well, we'll try and keep up with you as best we can. Thank you very much for being our guest today, Edwina.
Thank you.
That's Edwina McCann. She's the editor of Harper's Bazaar Australia. And time now to go to our obsessions. What have we been obsessing about? What's caught your attention? What's captured your eye? Jason?
I've given in. I've given in to the ratings success of the season, and that is My Kitchen Rules. I'm completely hooked by this bitchy, catty show. The sparks were flying this week. My goodness. It's not about cooking. It's just about how, it's about bitching. I just can't believe how captivating it is.
Well, that's a confession indeed. What about you, Mark?
I retreated to my 17-year-old self and got to see Roger Waters doing Pink Floyd's The Wall this week in Sydney at the Acer Arena. And I was expecting something very much like what I would have seen in 1980 if I'd actually been able to go to the shows to see it. Instead, I got this amazing multimedia spectacle that was very much a reflection of the present time, and it really affected me. I came out, and the next day I actually was looking at booking flights to Auckland so I could go see it there next week. But it drew a lot, it seemed, from Banksy and from sort of the sort of subversion culture and all of the stuff that's going on in culture right now around culture jamming was all worked into it.
I'm just completely silly. I saw the oldest cat video in known history on the internet this week. It was taken in 1894 in a studio, and it's two little cats in a boxing ring with boxing gloves on. I still don't understand why cats are so intriguing and why cats and video were meant to be, or film were meant to be together. But anyway,
meant to be together. Yes.
I'll put a little link on the website as well. That's it for Common Knowledge this week. Thank you to writer and futurist Mark Pesci for being our guest this week.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at @RN_CK. And of course, you can podcast the show and leave comments at the website. Go to abc.net.au/Radio National and follow the links to the Common Knowledge program page. Time to say goodbye. I'm Jason DeRosso.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next week.